Paper 119, Section 6, which is old single column, page 1315. Let's see. Section 6, sixth pistole. Remember, if you need a reminder, look back on your list of what's happening with each of the pistoles. We have this son-like pistole, and then, of course, the father-like one when he was here. And as we'll read right away at the beginning, Gabriel was on the last two as an attendant. Of all the reasons we've talked about a number of times, where he's got a, and you'll see they mention how that's becoming all the more relevant here with this one. And then also remember the special thing about this one is that he has a seraphim, because this is a sun-like one. He's very literally, he's an ascending sun in the local universe. The mother influence is extremely important all the way up through the local universe. That seraphim, as a direct offspring of that very definitively local mother, very definitively mother-like local mother, our creative mother spirit, is there as an attendant to foster that in ways that we, don't obviously understand directly, as we talked about at the beginning, that's a pretty obvious linkage there to what's going on, so that he, he has the appropriate environment in which this deity phenomenon, with all of its mystery, the mystery of the incarnations, this deity phenomenon can engage, literally engage, supremacy and supreme type deity can infuse into his nature. So we've got just the last two steps, and then he'll have that accomplished, where he will, as he is now, be a representation in his measure of the nature of God the Supreme. So who would like to?
Let me ask a question. Michael and Nebadon, the Universe Mother Spirit, were basically created for each other. So obviously they've got this link. Mm-hmm. Do you think that those links during these bestowals, particularly the one on your Urantia, was severed?
Remember how it works, though, especially when he's here. He's engaged to the Creative Mother Spirit up to his baptism in the exact same way that you are. There's nothing, special. He's true man, not God-augmented man. He's true man. And so he's, being engaged by the seven mind adjutants, and then he's being encircuited in the Holy Spirit. And so, he's definitely engaged to her in that way, but that's, our way. Nothing special about that, relative to the normal process, as you probably remember, they emphasize in the seventh pistole, that there wasn't anything different about it. Now, once, he's basically done with the seventh pistole after the baptism, and he chooses to stay, now there's, all kinds of additional things in play that transcend you and I. But
during the rest of this downstep, mm-hmm. and he's going through, mm-hmm. as we upstep, mm-hmm. I'm assuming there's going to be, certainly we're going to have a mind connection with her.
He's got a Urantia mind, in this bestowal we're about to read, just like we will.
So his connection with her is expanding as he's going down, the same way ours will expand as we go up.
Right. I mean, each time he does one of these bestowals going down, He is augmenting the relationship with the Creative Mother Spirit, so that as a master son now, you know, he has a relationship to her that he didn't have before.
Okay.
They're really functioning in a supremacy equality that wasn't there prior to that.
Right.
That's why, you know, she didn't fully open her arms, if you will, you know, to his directing influence until that. And it's not because, you know, there's some sort of arbitrary thing in play. He can't, you know, technically. And he can't engage the holistic supremacy-like character that she has until he has that nature. So
is that final link, the thought,
the spirit of truth? See, the very fact that he can put his personal spiritual ministry out on her wholeness, you know, that's because he has a measured relationship to supremacy. It's the only reason he can do that.
So she's essentially achieved that at the primary eruption, just a step function?
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's building, because, you know, like he said, I mean, they're very linked. So she's, you know, she is coalescing in character, too, throughout this whole process. But you know, she's much more like the rest of the supreme creators to start with, and that there's a that supremacy. You know, remember how we were you know, using this chart to think about that. You've got, you know, all the supreme creators and supreme controllers down in these lower three levels, and to start out with, there's one hole in that. In the ubiquity of supremacy in those six squares there. And that's, you know, he's only a creator son, not a master son. So once he becomes a master son, then that you have supremacy throughout that whole supreme creator domain. Yeah.
Spirit of truth was poured out only on this world or all of Nebadon?
Well, it's all of Nebadon, but it's only engaging our world and worlds that had a bestowal son prior, where, you know, they poured out their spirit upon that world when they were a bestowal son. When he does his bestowal, then all of those spirit of truths get upstepped so that it's equivalent. But, you know, worlds that haven't had a bestowal son yet, you know, and of course, there's a lot of worlds that haven't even gotten life implantation yet, you know, whatnot. You know, and there's nothing engaged there yet.
But when they achieve that, they'll have the fully augmented spirit of truth.
Right. For instance, the neighboring planet. You know, at the time of the writing, you know, they hadn't even gotten a magisterial son yet. Okay. See, so. You know, they didn't get the benefit of the spirit of truth there. They don't even have their local magisterial son, like, you know, spirit of truth there yet. So and then they make that point at the end of that paper that's, you know, one, you know, reminding us of how important it is that we have that, how much that accelerates the process of evolving. Yeah. So, all right. So let's just jump in. Let's start reading the sixth bestowal here.
Sixth bestowal. Now that all Salvington was familiar with the preliminaries of an impending bestowal, Michael called the sojourners on the headquarters planet together and for the first time unfolded the remainder of the incarnation plan, announcing that he was soon to leave Salvington for the purpose of assuming the career of a Marantia mortal at the courts of the Most High Fathers on the headquarters planet of the fifth constellation. And then we heard for the first time the announcement that his seventh and final bestowal would be made on some evolutionary world in the likeness of mortal flesh.
Just one little quick thing. Remember, we're talking, this is 150 million years ago. So, I mean, it's just, you know, to the extent that they just said there. I mean, there's obviously no concept that it's going to be Urantia 150 million years ago. I mean, 150 million years ago, we're right around the beginning of the Triassic. You know, we haven't even made it to reptiles on this planet yet. Okay. So,
Would have been early to call it.
Yeah, a little early to call it. The rebellion was not obvious at that point. Don't ever forget the time scales here. 150 million years ago. They remember how they were pointing out that they start with this very parochial viewpoint of things, and they're slowly being educated about the ways of the universe as this is going forward. They're getting word that it's going to be in the likeness of mortal flesh.
Do you remember, was Lucifer in charge of this area?
I mean, this is constellation number 5. This is totally.
No, I mean, at the time, was he in charge of
ours? Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
He was in place a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't remember.
Yeah, he was the system sovereign, all the way back. And there were worlds in this system, very, very, very long time ago. Yeah, yeah. So just like all of the other, like we've tried to point out, I mean, not only Lucifer, of course, you wouldn't have called him Lucifer really back then, but all of the sovereign system sovereigns were solid for ages and ages and ages and ages.
Before leaving Salvington for the sixth bestowal, Michael addressed the assembled inhabitants of the sphere and departed in full view of everyone, accompanied by a lone seraphim and the bright and morning star of Nebadon. While the direction of the universe had again been entrusted to Emmanuel, there was a wider distribution of administrative responsibilities.
Just, little things in each one. Try to pull something beyond the surface out of each one of them if you can. Just think about that last little thing. It's like, well, why? There was a wider distribution of administrative responsibilities. Why? So you can start reflecting on it. Try to think of, what might it be? There's obviously, they've already told you that this is going on as, the farther down he goes, the more he is really letting go. He lets go to this degree, even though he might be in touch with Gabriel, and Gabriel, is in touch with Emmanuel. I mean, he is not able to jump in and engage his administrative responsibilities like he could have when he was higher up. We all know that it didn't really start to happen to any definitive degree here until after the baptism, that he was really engaging that Michael duties, that he has. But another thing, it's like, I don't know, I mean, is there that much difference between being a spirit fuser a third stage spirit, in the previous bestowal, and Marantia Ascender here? Is there really that big a difference in how much connectivity he has? Well, it's like, maybe he's a spirit being, as a third stage spirit, but he's on Uversa. It's kind of out of out of play. The thought I have is, one possibility is that he might be going to be on this bestowal for a longer span of time. And so, remember some of them, in local universe years, it's like 20 local universe years, which is not that long for them. Maybe he's going to be on this bestowal for a lot longer. So they really need to kind of set up not just some quick little temporary things, but a little bit more long-term issues, perhaps. So that's one thought you might have. If anyone else can think of some other possibilities, jump in. But statements like that are begging you to stop and see if, it's like, what do I know? What could I put to use there? They're trying to get you to really think in this this higher sphere of existence. You're a cosmic citizen. You're not just this super, super parochial, human on this little rock out in the middle of nowhere? Can you start to see yourself living and thinking about the goings-on in a bigger context? They want you to do that. Start to feel comfortable with contemplating such things and not say, well, whatever, you know, what difference does that make in my life?
Maybe he had more help from other universes and he was getting less help from other universes. I don't know. I'm just speculating.
You could speculate a lot. We know that there's many, many more times than what he does say that he could have said, that even Gavalia knows about but wasn't allowed to say. So, who knows? Maybe there is other things going on, other relationships with other local universes or something like that. That's not beyond the realm of speculation. We know it was happening with, for instance, when the Planetary Prince came. You got that mysterious thing that they have this surgeon from Avalon, one of the neighboring local universes come, and you're going, what the heck is up with that? Don't we have the people here? There's all kinds of mysterious things like that going on. And, there's all kinds of unrevealed things. There's a lot of unrevealed local universe suns. There's local universe suns besides Melchizedek, Pharaonidex, Lenonidex, material suns, etc. There's a bunch of unrevealed ones. It's not just the unrevealed beings in the local universe aren't just other lesser types, archangels, brilliant evening stars, that sort. There's actually local universe suns that are unrevealed. So there could be all kinds of things going on tied with these that either he couldn't say or even he doesn't even appreciate. So, yeah.
But these bestowals did happen among the orders that they revealed to us.
Yeah. But it does kind of remind you, remember how last week we were talking about, some other creator's son and some other local universe,
right.
See, he could bestow himself as one of those other local universe sons that we don't even know anything about, for instance.
I'm just wondering if that happened. It was a factor in what they decided to reveal to us.
If they hadn't revealed Melchizedek, Pharaonidex, and Lenonidex, it'd be pretty hard to explain, anything, right? Your first guess is those unrevealed sons are not directly involved with the ascension career, that they're involved with the other six schemes that go on in the super universes. Again, you just don't know. There's just, not a clue, really.
Was he looking forward to the fact that not too far in the future he would be a master son? He announces his last.
Right, he obviously, you can see that those thoughts are.
I wonder if at that point, all the power is focalized on him as a master son, but the administration may diffuse or change considerably at that point as well.
Yeah, it's, they give you clues that things are changing significantly post these last. Bestowals, that there's a lot of transformation going on in the local universe. Things are being done quite differently. So there's lots of room to start really thinking about the bigger picture. And, don't be bashful about doing it. The relators very much encourage us to enjoy speculating about the bigger picture like they do.
Every Friday night, they're
jumping
up.
All right.
Michael appeared on the headquarters of Constellation 5 as a full-fledged Marantia mortal of ascending status. I regret that I am forbidden to reveal the details of this unnumbered Marantia mortal's career, for it was one of the most extraordinary and amazing epochs in Michael's bestowal experience, not even accepting his dramatic and tragic sojourn on Urantia. But among the many restrictions imposed upon me in accepting this commission is one which forbids my undertaking to unfold the details of this wonderful career of Michael as the Marantia mortal of edentum.
Edentum.
Why do you suppose they think that they can't tell us?
Why do they tell us they can't?
Yeah, right. I mean, you know, the first thing you notice is, you know, have I mentioned just how many restrictions I have imposed upon me? You know, so he's doing that again. But yeah, I mean, you're just, you're left to just wonder. I mean, you know, it's a pretty amazing statement. You know, not even accepting his dramatic and tragic sojourn on Urantia. So this was apparently, you know, an experience that...
Maybe they figured
it would
take a whole other book.
Well, I was going to say, an experience that we probably could glean a lot from.
Yeah.
Now, you know, as soon as you say that, you're going, oh, well, maybe that's part of the reason. I mean, that would be jumping the gun. I mean, you know, we're a long ways from being, you know, at the constellation level, and, you know, we need to work our way there. That would be, you know, getting us ahead of the game. That certainly could be a big part of it. I don't know. Well,
what would Constellation 5, what would that be?
Well, just remember, we've got all these constellations. We've got 100 constellations in the local universe of Nebadon. And where they are, we don't know. I mean, you might guess that there could be some, you know, tendency for smaller numbers to be closer towards the center of the local universe, you know, and bigger numbers out, but, you know, you're speculating wildly when you say that. You know, we don't really know. I mean, you've got indirect clues, like, you know, what they chose to name our constellation, Nerlatia or Nerlashadek, you know, the Nor, that means north, you know, so you know that we're in the northern regions of the local universe as a constellation. But you know, all the way north. You know, I mean, you know,
It sounds counterproductive right now to compare the stoles, but maybe on the mansion worlds we might be able to appreciate it.
Oh yeah, I mean, they're good. As we read forward, you'll see they'll mention. We'll spend a lot of time studying this. They tell you that this was a very significant event for ascenders.
Do you think that the Edentum is a place?
Edentum is the capital, just like Edentia is the capital of our constellation. That's the capital of that constellation, constellation number 5. So again, they've coined a word, and I guess as long as I've said that, I'm pretty sure I've figured this one out. Look for me to post an update to the etymology. I'm still challenging it. I'm still seeing if I can refute my thoughts on it. But I've been working on it for about a week now, trying to break what I think I know about it. So
hanging together so far.
Yeah, it's hanging together so far. you know, it obviously is a word that reminds you of Edentia to start with, just, you know, the sequence of letters. But anyway, yeah, it's the capital, to your point, Pam, you know, you just really can't say it's somewhere in our local universe, and we don't know where.
And Chris, you said north, but north of what?
Well, I mean, remember how they, everything's going around in this elliptical path around the central universe.
That's a good question.
And they call, you know, we're the seventh super universe. We're just coming around the southern bend of the ellipse, and we're heading, you know, to be moving along the long northerly track. You know, so they, in this orientation, north is that way and south is that way. So that means that, you know, here's the super universe, you know, here's the Milky Way galaxy. So somewhere out here, you know, towards the outer part is Nebadon, you know, and so, we're somewhere, you know, here in Nebadon rather than here in Nebadon. You know, we're towards the northern side, you know, rather than the southern side of Nebadon relative to this, you know, relative to the grand universe geometry.
Okay.
Her name is going to change in a couple of billion years.
Right. But for right now, that's, you know, they coined that name to give us a sense of, you know, your location relative to things. All right, so let's see what else they tell us here.
When Michael returned from this Maranja Bestowal, it was apparent to all of us that our Creator had become a fellow creature, that the universe sovereign was also the friend and sympathetic helper of even the lowest form of created intelligence in his realms. We had noted this progressive acquirement of the creature's viewpoint in universe administration before this, for it had been gradually appearing, but it became more apparent after the completion of the Maranja Bestowal, mortal bestowal, even still more so after his return from the career of the carpenter's son on Urantia.
Okay, so there's a little clue about what's going on. So that's a hint about the differential between the previous bestowal, where he was a spirit being, you know, a third stage spirit ascender, and now. Before, you know, that one and all those before, he's some kind of, you know, spirit being, or, you know, if he's a material son, that's a, you know, that's basically spirit made flesh, you know, in many ways. But now he is really engaging a nature that has a great differential. Even in literal substance that he is engaging. And so that's why they're saying that. I mean, when he comes back, you know, he came back, he still was and still is that ascender. Just like now he is still Jesus, like he was here. So they really could see that there was an energy, you know, and a nature difference that was very marked now that he's infused himself with this, you know, sub-spiritual, basically, you know, nature. Celestial level, you know, nature. There was
somewhere.
Ascender.
That's
okay. Yeah.
Imagine him as an ascender.
Right. He's obviously very definitively an ascender. And see, and again, you have to wonder kind of about, you know, what we brought up at the beginning. You know, he now is going to be engaging the mother in ways that he never has, and retaining that. So that's going to be a significant part of what's going on here. You know, the contrast between his existential beginning and very father-like, in terms of, you know, father-son spirit, you know, if you're father-son, you're definitely on the father-like side of existential nature. And, you know, now has a very definitive, different nature fused to that. And, it's going to really take on what the difference is between what a being that's just existential deity looks like and what a being that also is definitively experiential deity looks like. You know, that's part of what they're seeing here.
And you mentioned earlier, when he was here, it was the most extreme mind difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the big difference. Yeah, that's I'm glad you said that. It made me think, pointing this out, you know, the really, really big difference, mindily. Remember how to think about mind. You start out with cosmic mind up at the super universe level, and that gets downstepped via the Creative Mother Spirit down into the local universe. And when she downsteps that cosmic mind into the local universe, it splits in two. You have the more unity-like, spirit-like core of that cosmic mind, which we call the Holy Spirit. And then you have the more individuality-like part that splits off from that unity. And for us, that's Maranja mind, you know, or for him in this. Okay? you know, or for angel, you know, seraphim and whatnot. It's the equivalent. It's, you know, it's that, it's a singular facet of mind. It's not seven facets like the edge. It's a singular facet, and it's, you know, it varies to match the being, Raja, Sender, or whatnot. Yeah. And then it's only when she downsteps that another notch down to engage a planet that, you know, the Holy Spirit keeps coming down unmodified, you know, that core of the cosmic mind. But that one facet of mind splits into seven because it's trying to engage more individuality, so it has to individuate more. You know, there has to be a whole spectrum. You know, one end is close to unity, and the other end, the first adjutant, is the most removed from the Holy Spirit, the most individuality-like. It has to literally be able to engage mechanical mind, you know, which is very, very individuality, you know, like. So you get this whole spectrum from individuality to unity. That's what he's experiencing. He's experiencing having a consciousness that is not automatically, what word would I use? Incorporated into the unity, you know, you have to choose identification with the Holy Spirit. You have to choose greater identification with unity. So he's having to make that choice for the first time. You know, to not have that separateness from his, of the unity from his individuality.
Is he using mortal mind at this point?
No, he's using Marantia mind. He's a Marantia being, a Marantia sender. So he's, okay. You know, his body and, you know, his brain, you know, are like your soul. They're made out of Marantia substance. And he is encircuited in the Holy Spirit, but it just, as always, it's not automatically. You have to choose to bring that that greater cosmic harmony into your consciousness.
Just like us after we're
is the creative mother spirit the same as it's different than the Supreme, God Supreme?
Yeah, totally different. The similarity is in the mother aspect. They're very different in many other ways, but you can think of the mother-like, you know, the mother-type deity that a creative mother spirit has is a downstepped expression of the mother-type deity that's at the supreme level, the universal mother. You downstep the universal mother at the supreme level down to a local universe mother. So, see how that phenomenon of downstepping the mother is similar to what's going on with, as he's going through his bestowals. You have the fullness of supreme type deity, and he is becoming a downstepped measure of that, that is tuned to his existential nature, just like the mother-like deity that the creative mother spirit has is tuned to her existential nature. You know, she started out with as an existential being, a creative spirit, a downstepped expression of the infinite spirit, just existential deity. Okay? And then she has experiential deity, you know, attached to that, you know, tied to that. And both of them are doing this. And so both of them have, you know, are, you have the whole supreme, you know, and there's this little focused expression in two different ways. One of the full power personality synthesis, the supreme-like deity. The other, just the mother-like aspect of it, not the almighty-like aspect, you know, or the super additive consequence of the relationship between the two. Just the mother-like part. Okay, so that's why I was saying earlier, so you can see that they can now kind of function on equal terms after he's a master son. They both are, you know, in their own way, are these full downstepped expressions from the supreme level to a local place to give that one unique flavor of expression of the supreme amongst all the seven super universes.
So he's a
She's the creative mother spirit.
Mm-hmm.
He's the creative.
The creator son, and then a master son. So as a creator son, he's father and son type stuck together. And now he's adding supreme type as a master son. let's see. I think that's probably enough. Let's do the next one here.
We were informed in advance by Gabriel of the time of Michael's release from the Maranja Bestowal. And accordingly, we arranged a suitable reception on Salvington. Millions upon millions of beings were assembled from the Constellation Headquarters worlds of Nebadon, and a majority of the sojourners on the worlds adjacent to Salvington were gathered together to welcome him back to the rulership of his universe. In response to our many addresses of welcome and expressions of appreciation of a sovereign so vitally interested in his creatures, he only replied, "I have simply been about my father's business. I am only doing the pleasure of the paradise sons who love and crave to understand their creatures."
Everyone always chuckles at that matter-of-fact reply. You can imagine how elaborate, and he just makes this one little statement and goes back to work. They had fireworks and streamers and, and a lot like, what the apostles had to deal with, he just would never feed their desire to, to grab a hold of the whole aggrandizement, thing. And, it's just simple stuff here. Now, notice one thing in here. See, again, notice the little choice of words. They're not random. A sovereign so vitally, this distinction is vital. See, that's what they're starting to notice, is how much more literally connected with them through the mother that he is after this one. They can feel that greater connection to him. That's why I say it's so obvious why the seraphim is extra attendant. He is very much, the distinction between the previous ones and this bestowal is vital. Okay? He's really starting to become part of the cosmic system in a way he wasn't before. The way someone who's just existential deity can't be. He's starting to have the ability to really begin to be connected through the mother to everyone else in a very direct way. And they feel it, and they admire it, appreciate it.
This is well before Lucifer's breakdown.
Yeah. But it's not, it's well after the previous two breakdowns.
Does the completion of seven bestowals bulletproof Nebadon in a way that nothing else can from rebellion?
Well, you're kind of keying into, think about the consequences of what I just said. Okay, if he's literally now more connected into the grid, of persons, if you will. The mother establishes a grid between personalities. We're connected through her. If he's literally plugged into that grid now in a way that he wasn't before, that's going to infect the whole grid. Think about how that's literally with us. I mean, the fact that he's plugged into the grid is why we have the spirit of truth engaged to us.
Yeah.
It's because he's in the grid. We're connected to the grid, and he's in the grid now. We're encircled in the Holy Spirit. We're plugged into the grid. He's in there now. And so that changes everything. So you don't pick up on it unless you start really looking closely. Remember what I pointed out. He told us, he wants us to carefully think about why he chose each word. Why did he say vitally here? And all those little details. He's trying to give you as much as he can so that you can get the sense of what's going on here and why you're going to spend so much time studying this.
My hands are tied, so just pick up on it.
Yeah,
Judy and I were talking about this the other day as far as his miracles, especially Lazarus. Lazarus, and of course him raising himself from the dead. Or even the woman who touched his garment. She had the faith, but he had the juice.
He was plugged in. Yeah. Just one little thing.
Not quite down.
Want to comment, since you kind of brought in Lazarus, that little aside, you know, even in the case of, Jesus slash Michael doing that, or dash Michael, I guess I should say, not slash, it's not or, it's and. he didn't literally do it. I mean, he said do it, and the beings went in and put Lazarus' body back together again. So this is another thing to remember about, well, I think I could do that. Well, do you think you can command the master physical controllers and the midwayers to put a body back together again? I don't think so. Not even your angels, listen to your prayers. They're doing their job. You're not wielding the spiritual beings.
Sometimes the only way we can say I exist is to beat our own drum, and humility at this level seems so rare, but I expect as we ascend, humility is more and more common because we're more known.
Yeah, just think about that relationship, what we're just talking about. Part of the reason why he just naturally expresses this humility, don't think beyond the words. Think about how he would have come across expressing it here, post this bestowal. Yeah. He is literally less cut off from others. He literally is more connected with others. But, remember that's one of the things that, like Chris was pointing out, that's slowly changing in the local universe. More and more individuals are not thinking of him as arrogant, as being so arrogant as they used to think of him. You still have a holdout in Lucifer, thinking, now who in the heck does he think he is, telling us what to do, blah, blah, blah. Lucifer didn't see him as humble. But as he's going through these bestowals, more and more everyone sees him as humble. And I can't help but think that's probably because he just is literally more connected to them. It affects the way they experience him and the way he expresses himself. He might have been, internally humble when he was expressing himself, way before all these bestowals, but it just wouldn't have come off that way. It's kind of like when we listen to the archangel talking to us, and he just doesn't come off warm and fuzzy. He comes off very prickly, and standoffish and whatnot, and all those archangels. Yeah, no one even dares talk to them, and all this sort of stuff. We've talked about that a lot. Think about how people would have experienced Michael, before he could really connect to them on their level, like he's now able to, and they receive his humility now.
Well, the point I'm making is that he doesn't have to come back and report on what happened know.
They also didn't. The midwayers didn't tell us about his Maharajah career here on our planet as well.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah, but still, it was the more it was definitively his Maharajah career, the less they tell you about it in the Jesus papers.
Yeah.
That does remind you of this. So probably the big thing there is that would be getting us ahead of ourselves. But all right. There's one big thing I forgot before you said it. I totally forgot. There was one other. There's a biggie thing we got to point out in this thing.
A biggie thing.
Okay. That's a technical term. It is millions upon millions. After all, it's kind of a biggie thing. Millions upon millions of beings were assembled from the Constellation Headquarters worlds of Nevena. Okay, that statement has consequences. In other words, this bestowal has to have lasted hundreds of Urantia years. You're not going to get beings from every Constellation Headquarters world, into Salvington. Plus you got millions and millions to transport. I mean, this is a serious logistics endeavor, and we're talking big distances.
You'd have to have a fairly large venue.
Right. Well, Salvington is a large venue. It's a very large venue. You got to have a lot of lead time. I mean, you can make some back of the envelope calculations, about how big a local universe might have to be. Let's say that, let's say it was 1,200 light years, in radius, if you kind of thought of it as spherically. So let's say someone had to come 1,200 light years. Well, three times the speed of light, that's going to take 400 years.
Yeah.
Okay.
Send out the invites early.
So, we're talking that, this bestowal, you could say, well, maybe it was like about 500, Urantia years, say, just roughly. Well, that'd be about 100 Nevadon years. Maybe we're talking about something about like that, rather than 20 or 40 or, maybe this is about 100 Nevadon years for this one. And that would give them probably plenty of time to come from any constellation. You can think about roughly things like that. It's got to be hundreds of years. How many hundreds? I don't know, but it's got to be hundreds. Or you just couldn't get all these beings to Salvington.
I don't understand why you think they have to be transported.
How else are they going to get there?
Don't they dematerialize?
No. There's no magic here.
Star Trek.
I mean, magic. If you're an archangel, let's say you're an archangel and you want to go from Salvington to Urantia, you got to be transported. You can't fly. You take a transport seraphim from Salvington to Urantia. They go at most three times the speed of light.
So what do you do on a long road trip like that?
Yeah.
you
get some serious reflection time in.
How did he get back so quickly?
Ah, see, that's the thing you got to remember. We talked about that. You might have been here when we were talking about that. That's part of the secret of the incarnation. How he, he's standing on Salvington along with Gabriel and the seraphim one moment, and then the next moment, he's over on the headquarters world of Constellation number 5, which may not be 1,200 light years away, but it's going to be a ways away. And this is part of the mystery. Somehow they go from point A to point B, on the third day he's there, this is part of the mystery. No one knows how this happens. Remember, the reason we've really brought that out, the clue to this is when he's a seraphim, serving as a supreme seraphim, and he's going to all kinds of different places around the local universe functioning, and the whole time no one has any idea, who he is. He's not traveling by transport. They could track him. They never knew where he was. He's going from point A to point B without going in between, so no one is tracking a transport,
Yeah, but if you're responsible for creating the whole thing, you could build in your own methods of transportation that we don't know about, right?
Right, but see, what you're talking about here is something that not even the highest finite beings have any clue about, okay? So, we're talking about something by definition is transcending the finite. This is something, which, if you think about it, it has to be that. It's got to be like reflectivity, where point A and point B are connected without having to, wait for something to travel from point A to point B. So it's not surprising that he's engaging supremacy and being able to do this. You're really talking about the same thing. He's functioning in relationship to the whole right from the very first bestowal, he is going from point A to point B without going in between. He's engaging supremacy. He's engaging the whole.
How do millions of beings see him on the sea of glass? And
oh, well, you know, or how do billions of beings, you know, and
TV screens?
Remember, see, we tried to point that out. I mean, think about going to Gerasim, you know, and sitting in the stadium with billions of people. How on earth are those people in the nosebleed seats seeing what's happening on the stage? See, again, you're not seeing like this. I mean, you know, the mind or your consciousness fills all of Nevadon. Okay, you just put your consciousness over there to the stage and see it. You know, you're remote viewing.
You know,
that's how you can.
That's so cool.
You know,
it is.
Because obviously there isn't a pair of binoculars big enough, you know, for those people in those nosebleed seats to see the stadium. I don't care, you know, how great of optics they have on Gerasim. You're not using, you know, you're not seeing it like we, you know.
So they would be speaking telepathically?
Right, you're speaking, yeah, you're speaking.
But how do they know, like, out of millions, who got to speak? Like, how long did it take?
Chris?
Years?
You want me to explain the protocol of mindal functioning? You know, I don't know how this works. They obviously have some way of doing this.
You're
going to
find out,
Terry. No.
It sounds like another sense.
Right. Well, remember, there's gazillions more senses. Remember, you know, once you leave this, you know, before serving two masters, you have all kinds of additional senses. Because, see, you're not having to pump your consciousness through a body and the limited things that a body can do to give you input. You know, you're engaging things much more directly, mindily. So you have all kinds of different ways that you're inputting, you know, and you know, you're obviously going to be able to engage things in much more holistic ways. I mean, if I want to be aware of this whole arm, I got to move my hand across it like this. You know, I'll be able to disengage the whole arm simultaneously with a sense of touch, you know, and things like this. You know, you'll be able to engage things much more holistically. Okay, so anyway, yeah, just, you know, just noticing little things like that. That's, and so that obviously, see, seems to tie with why they had to, you know, do a lot more with the administrative stuff before. You know, he's obviously on a lot longer mission here, or you just couldn't have had this happening. You know, you're just guessing. I mean, did Gabriel tell him right away? You know, or halfway through it, or you know, seven-eighths of the way through it? I mean, you know. If you know, even if he told him right away, we're still talking, you know, this thing had to be, you know, 400, 500 years long. You know, what if he didn't tell him until close to the end? Then this thing could have been a long, long time.
Yeah. We'll be back in 100 years. Let's
try
to get ready.
Ready? Yep.
Go.
But from that day down to the hour when Michael embarked upon his Urantia adventure as the Son of Man, all Nevadon continued to discuss the many exploits of their sovereign ruler as he functioned on Endantum as the bestowal incarnation of a Marantia mortal of evolutionary ascension. Being in all points tested like his fellows assembled from the material worlds of the entire constellation of his sojourn.
Yeah, so that, I mean, that's pretty straightforward. Unless anyone has any other questions, we can move on to the next one here.
Seventh and final bestowal. For tens of thousands of years, we all looked forward to the seventh and final bestowal of Michael. Gabriel had taught us that this terminal bestowal would be made in the likeness of mortal flesh, but we were wholly ignorant of the time, place, and manner of this culminating adventure.
Well, okay, think about the beginning of that paragraph and the end of that paragraph. Put those two things together. Okay, we're talking about 150 million years apart here, okay? And they just say for tens of thousands of years they were all looking? Okay, so in other words, these things, there must not be a lot of variation in this roughly 150 million year, you know, period here between them. It's got to be, you know, the previous ones must have varied only a little bit about some number. That's roughly 150 million years, or, you know, they didn't, you know, they weren't waiting for millions of years or hundreds of thousands of years, you know, they knew it's like, okay, well, now we're, say, 100,000 years away from it, you know, and we're waiting. You know, they don't know when it's going to be, you know, plus or minus 100,000 years or something. But see, there's a little clue there. But still, you know, even in the sense of the inner circuit of Avona, you know, being the day sort of, for, you know, a day is like 1,000 years, that 1,000-year time, you know, that everyone is tied to some degree, the millennium. You know, even in that time scale, we're talking, you know, tens of days here. So it's,
The public announcement that Michael had selected Urantia as the theater for his final bestowal was made shortly after we learned about the default of Adam and Eve. And thus, for more than 35,000 years, your world occupied a very conspicuous place in the councils of the entire universe. There was no secrecy, aside from the incarnation mystery, connected with any step in the Urantia bestowal. From first to last, up to the final and triumphant return of Michael to Salvington as Supreme Universe Sovereign, there was the fullest universe publicity of all that transpired on your small but highly honored world.
Yes, and you remember the story about how gladdened Adam and Eve were by that little subtle comment, you know, that when Michael sent that message, you know, that, you know, where he hinted that, to them that he would be there. And Adam put the pieces together. He's like, well, you know, I think he must be saying that, you know, this is going to be his bestowal world. And, you know, he started telling everyone to spread the news at sometime in the distant future.
It had to be the talk of the universe saying, good grief, he's choosing a really difficult place to go.
Yeah, that's the next thing they point out. Yeah, just notice how they, you know, that's exactly where their thoughts are going.
A mortal sphere is one thing, this mortal sphere is
another. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, just
a challenge.
Yeah, just you know, I mean, we can just go ahead and just read right into these. Just notice how they start to talk about it.
While we believed that this would be the method, we never knew until the time of the event itself that Michael would appear on Earth as a helpless infant of the realm. Theretofore, he had always appeared as a fully developed individual of the personality group of the bestowal selection. And it was a thrilling announcement which was broadcast from Salvington, telling that the babe of Bethlehem had been born on Urantia.
Maybe just one little aside that kind of ties into some of the speculations we were making last week about how different creator sons could do different types of bestowals. You know, like, for instance, you could imagine, let's say he was going to experience what it was like to be a mortal that is just a spirit fuser. You know, would he really have to be born a babe? You know, maybe he could just become an adult and, you know, and he'd get one of these temporary adjusters and, you know, and do that and you know, and then experience spirit fusion. You know, so things like that could be in their minds, and they're saying, you know, while we believed that this would be the method, we never knew, you know, so, you know, they're thinking, well, you know, that would seem to be logical if, you know, for our local universe that he would have to come as a babe in order to, you know, go through the whole experience, but we never like to, you know, presume that we know everything about all this. There's always the incarnation mystery that they are never willing to, you know, presume about. So, but anyway, yeah, see, so you could, you know, just, you know, even with what little we know, you could imagine that not every creator son actually is born a babe.
We then not only realized that our creator and friend was taking the most precarious step in all his career, apparently risking his position and authority on this bestowal as a helpless infant, but we also understood that his experience in this final and mortal bestowal would eternally enthrone him as the undisputed and supreme sovereign of the universe of Nebadon. For a third of a century of Earth time, all eyes in all parts of this local universe were focused on Urantia. All intelligences realized that the last bestowal was in progress, and as we had long known of the Lucifer rebellion in Satania and of the Caligastia disaffection on Urantia, We well understood the intensity of the struggle which would ensue when our ruler condescended to incarnate on Urantia in the humble form and likeness of mortal flesh.
I love how, you know, in this context, the word condescend, you know, as a descending son, takes on such a magnificent new character. You know, you definitely have, he willfully, goes down to a lower level, but it's in this whole descending son sense that he's condescending, and so that's, it's kind of cool. You know, so you can see a couple things there. I mean, not only bringing up the rebellion, and they're going, whoa, there's going to be some struggle here. And then you've got the whole bit about, whoa, okay, so Michael is going to be a helpless infant. He's not even going to be encircuited in the Holy Spirit initially. He won't even have all the adjutants initially. Whoa, that's really putting yourself out on a limb.
Chris, how is it risking anything?
Well, notice the apparently. I mean, again, as far as they can tell, it's not like there's special shields around him. So, but they also know logically, this isn't going to somehow blow up. Michael is not going to cease to exist because somehow, when he's 2 months, in the womb, he dies. But
risking his position.
He's making himself open to death.
So briefly.
I mean, he can resurrect himself when he does die because he's Michael then. When he's 2 years old, he can't resurrect himself.
And there was California. When did he become Michael then?
After his baptism, now he's got the full Michael abilities in play. But
it's just a temporal risk. I mean, it doesn't really amount to.
Well, see, but see again. I mean, they're going. There is no net that we can see. As far as we can tell, apparently, this is true.
He's all in.
He's all in. And they're going, how cool is that? What a magnificent display of trust. So ask yourself that question: do you trust God that much?
Well, if all the universe knows that he's here, Caligastia and Lucifer mm-hmm. know that he's here. It's a little bit like Voldemort looking for Harry.
Yeah, yeah. It's very much like that.
I
yes.
mean,
you know,
Gabriel's there. Too,
yeah, Gabriel's got
that. Right. I mean, he's got the army there, but still,
Joseph and Mary. Yeah. I mean, they're out there.
Harry has an army. But so does Voldemort. when you think of that word, when they say struggle, think about that sequence that is in play here. Effort, struggle, conflict, faith, determination, love, loyalty, and progress. They're recognizing that Michael is going to experience that. He's going to have to draw upon faith to overcome the struggle and the conflict that is obviously going to be in play here. To muster a determination that he's never had to muster before, because it's been pretty automatic. It's not automatic now. He has to choose it. He has to grab a hold of the faith required to have the determination required, to be able to demonstrate love and loyalty like is going to be required, to progress like is required, just like us.
Talking about that temporal risk, there was this guy named Herod who was going around killing babies.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the other side was busy.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we all know the coincidentalities, on that, I mean, see, he's not just trusting in God the Father and all of his interventionary agents.
No.
He's trusting in the Mother and supremacy. Coincidentally, it didn't turn out how it might have. That's the mother. He's trusting in the mother. He's trusting in that providence. You know, there's an expression of the presence of the mother.
Well, the humans, particularly Joseph and Mary, you know, they took the responsibility of parents to, you know, save his life from the very beginning.
He's trusting in parents to recognize their duty. He's, you know, it's all in play. He's putting it all out there. Third of a century, it's, you know, he was almost 36 when he was killed. We all know the full story there.
Joshua ben Joseph, the Jewish baby, was conceived and born into the world just as all other babies before and since, except that this particular baby was the incarnation of Michael of Nebadon, the divine son of paradise and the creator of all this local universe of things and beings. And this mystery of the incarnation of deity within the human form of Jesus, otherwise of natural origin on the world, will forever remain unsolved. Even in eternity, you will never know the technique and method of the incarnation of the Creator in the form and likeness of his creatures. That is the secret of Sunarrington, and such mysteries are the exclusive possession of those divine sons who have passed through the bestowal experience.
Okay, it's all pretty straightforward. Now, before we read this next paragraph, a lot of you know this next paragraph has probably the most notorious sentence in the entire book. And I'm pretty sure, yeah, in yours, when you get to the second to the last sentence, notice where it says, visited the newborn child. The rest of the words are in the manger, which I don't think are in yours, right?
No.
Yeah. So, for, you know, there's a bunch of you that won't have the words in the manger finishing up that sentence.
Who's it, what book does?
First printing does, and then some of the newer ones where it's been put back in. We're going to talk about all this in detail. But just that it's the most notorious sentence in the book because of this issue, and we'll flesh that out. So when you get to that, just remember, read in the manger at the end of that sentence. Yep.
What is so different about Melchizedek incarnating? Isn't that a mystery also?
If you go back and read about the Melchizedeks have, by nature, can morph themselves into different expressions. And see, they're doing that, you know, they're not incarnating, you know, in the same sense that, you know, they're not, notice what they said here. Yeah, you know, it's not just a high being. You know, it's deity. Remember that? Remember, I tried to point that out. The real key mystery here is you have a creator personality manifesting as a creature personality. There's only two types of first source personality. Those are the two types. They are, you know, different. you can't morph, you know, black into white. Okay, black is black and white is white. And so this is just a mind-numbing mystery to them. How on earth can, you know, you can imagine high divinity being the lesser divinity, you know, just sort of, you know, put some of it under a bushel for a moment. Okay, how on earth does deity be not deity? That doesn't make sense.
This is almost a square circle.
Right. This is how can you make a square circle? There's a mystery, see here, that transcends. And like I said, the only way that you can do this, you know, we understand you have to go back around through the first source and center and back around the other way. Because this way it's square circles. And so you know it's not going that way. You know it can't be literally illogical. It just has to be it has to be logic in a way that transcends all understanding of lesser beings. It's using a connection between two facts that is unknown to even very high beings. Yeah. There is no transformation function, you know. that can go like, but with Melchizedek, they understand how he can morph himself into, you know, different expressions. That's one of the interesting little things about Melchizedek. You go and read that they have this plastic sort of character to them. Plato, yeah.
Don has a question.
Oh, well, was there?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. So let's do this. Let's do this part.
I have a question.
Oh, you do? Okay.
More than anything else, I just wanted to make a comment that the last sentence in this paragraph is completed. That is the secret of Sanarrington. That is the secret, or one of the secrets.
Well, I mean, each of the seven worlds has a secret. I mean, for you, you know, connected to Ascendington eventually, what is your secret that no other being will ever be able to comprehend? You know, the mystery of mysteries that's attached to you. You know, there's a set of mystery of mysteries. You're connected to one of those mystery of mysteries. You know, literally, you are going to know how it is that an adjuster can contact a mortal. Okay? You're going to know that. Beings that don't have any relationship to fusion are clueless and always will be about that. You know, they know that all these ascenders fuse, but again, it's connecting two things that, as far as they're concerned, that square circle. Okay, you can't connect that to that. There is no means of connecting those two things. It's completely like this, and yet they observe that they are connected. Somehow they meet. Somehow they're on the same plane of nature, and they can't comprehend how that could be. You know, you will know that. You will understand that intimately.
It might be important here to, you're using the right words. You're saying mystery, but you know, oftentimes you'll say there is no magic.
You notice, you know, remember how he said even in eternity. Okay, we're talking about something that transcends, you know, everything. You know, it's a transcendent mystery. Not just a mystery, it's a mystery of mysteries. That's what that expression means, that it transcends the finite, the absentite. I mean, it's a mystery above all mysteries.
It will stay a mystery.
Yeah, it will stay a mystery, except for those who experience it. If experience is literal, see? All right. So let's read this paragraph. We'll touch upon the little things in it, and then we'll go for the notorious sentence.
Certain wise men of Earth knew of Michael's impending arrival. Through the contacts of one world with another, these wise men of spiritual insight learned of the forthcoming bestowal of Michael on Urantia. And the seraphim did, through the midway creatures, make announcement to a group of Chaldean priests whose leader was Ardnon. These men of God visited the newborn child in the manger. The only supernatural event associated with the birth of Jesus was this announcement to Ardnon and his associates by the seraphim of former attachment to Adam and Eve in the first garden.
Okay, so it's like that last little bit. Okay, we're talking about Solonian crew. Okay, and we know from what they tell us up in the Jesus papers that, so the seraphim here, Solonian crew, want to get engaged with this here situation. So they get a midwayer to connect to Ardnon in a dream, to get into his mind in a dream, and get this message through. He's just giving you a little bit of behind the scenes stuff here. Just notice the way he words it, through the context of one world with another. See, he's giving you the stuff that goes beyond telling the story, the immediate story of Jesus' life. It's like, well, you know, there's some backstory, you know, and I can give you a couple little details, You know, most of the backstory, no. But this little bit of backstory, you know, I can give you. All right, so now, wait, do you have something first?
Well, it sounds like that there's angels involved. I mean, that's what angels do. I mean, do interplanetary.
Well, yeah, you're right. See, I mean, that's, yeah, that part of it. You've got, you know, even though the circuits are closed, so but you still have people coming here and talking to the seraphim that are here, and so that's how they knew what was going on.
That was the wise men back in Jesus' day.
Right, so this is, right, yeah, this is the wise men. You know, and so, yeah, they just got word directly by a visitor, you know, telling them, someone coming here, being transported here. Okay, so, now this sentence, these wise men of God visited the newborn child in the manger. This sentence has become a monument to many well-minded readers. Well-meaning. Well-minded is probably maybe a little strong. I'm sorry to say that, but they're at least well-meaning readers. But anyway, it's become a monument to these well-meaning readers as fact finders and rationalizers. What's going on with this sentence should make it plain to everyone for all time forward of this revelation about how you've got to challenge yourself out of this fact finder rationalizer mode. Okay, so the details. This is a copy of the first printing, you know, and so in the manger is here. Second printing on, it's not there. Well,
I have it in here.
Yeah. So what happened? It's back in some of the new ones. They, again, well-meaning readers go, well, now, wait a minute. Up in the Jesus papers, it says that the three wise men visited Jesus when he was almost 3 weeks old. You know, and he, the day after he was born, you know, I mean, the next day, they moved up to the inn. And so they're going, well, I mean, the next day he's up in the inn. I mean, 3 weeks later, you know, he's up in the inn. No manger. So, well-meaning throughout in the manger. Okay, it's back in again. Because the rationalizers are going, well, no, wait a minute. I mean, it says it's a manger. We know that mangers don't have to be troughs, great big troughs. Mangers sometimes are just little boxes. And a little box would be transportable. So, you know, they could have taken the manger, hauled the manger up to their room in the inn with him, and so he could have still been in the manger when, you know, technically in the manger when the wise men showed up, and he was almost 3 weeks old. Like, okay, you can certainly rationalize that. Let's think about that for a second. Well, I mean, the first thing that everyone should ask themselves is, well, now, wait a minute, I thought Joseph was a really good carpenter. And you're telling me that 3 weeks have gone by and this really good carpenter couldn't slam together something that was better than a box from the stables that they, you know, poured oats or whatever, you know, if that. That should make you think, well, okay, but, you know. Okay, but, you know, let's take this, let's stay on this track. Let's stay on the fact finder, rationalizer track. Okay, go to the Jesus papers. It says that Mary and Joseph get to Bethlehem. There's no room in the inn. But down below the inn on the hillside, there's an artificial cave that's been carved out for stables. And they're lodged there because the innkeepers have cleaned it up so the overflow could go there. And they tell you that towards the front was a grain storage room with some tent curtains set up. That's where Joseph and Mary were staying. You know, pretty. They thought, wow, this is really pretty decent things. You know, we've got curtains and everything. We're not just out in the open with Mary about to give birth.
They made it for overflow for the guest purpose.
Okay, but what does it say in there? It says, okay, that's that the grain storage room is toward the front, and immediately behind them, you know, back deeper in the cave, are the stalls and the mangers. It just says that, point blank. Okay. And then, you read down, and Jesus was born, and Mary wrapped him up and laid him in a nearby manger. Nearby manger, quote unquote. Yeah, so think about it. If these mangers are just little boxes that are really easily portable, wouldn't you pick up one of those boxes and bring it into the grain storage room rather than going back to the closest one behind you and putting him in the manger, in the nearby manger, the closest one to you?
Not for you.
Yeah. Doesn't sound like it. Okay. Okay. But it's even worse than that. I mean, if these guys were really good at their fact-finding and rationalizing, they would have thrown out another word out of this sentence. You know, or had to come up with another rationalization to keep that word in. Newborn. Okay? Newborn is a technical term. You are a newborn child only through the first 8 days in the Jewish concept. For instance, a male, he is circumcised on the 8th day. He's not a newborn after that. Okay? It was almost 3 weeks after he was born that the wise men arrived. He is not a newborn. Okay, he's a suckling child. They show up at the inn and he's there in Mary's arms, a suckling child. Okay, and they visit. Okay, he's not a newborn and he's not in the manger. That everyone is missing the whole point. You know they have to. This book is not accessible if you're in a fact finder, rationalizer mode. You've got to think in bigger terms, not wrong terms, bigger terms. Get yourself in a bigger mind mode. They're missing the whole point. And this should have been obvious because everyone knows, everyone should know, because it's not that secret of knowledge. Even in the Bible, when you go to Matthew, it doesn't say that the wise men visited him in the manger and that he was a newborn. In the Bible, it says that the wise men visited him in the house, the inn, Okay, and in the context, scholars recognize, they guess it was quite a bit bad. They think it may have been months, after he was born. It was only almost 3 weeks, but not, almost a month, but not months. Okay, I mean, this is known. Everyone who knows anything about, the Bible knows that they visited the, quote, the newborn child in the manger, end quote, that's a legend. That's common knowledge. That's a legend. Okay? So the fact that this is in there, I mean, the first thing is, just knowing that, think about what Gavalia is saying. He's saying, a certain wise man, blah, 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 and you're going, oh, you suppose he's talking about the wise man? Is he talking about the Magi? And then he says, yeah, the man in your legend, that's what I'm talking about. Okay. So, you know, you definitely make sure that you're on the right page. You know, you're not thinking, oh, there must have been some other ones. You know, these are the ones in your legend. Okay. But think about it. He was not even allowed to address the way it's stated in the Bible. The not legend story that's in the Bible. What has he told us over and over and over? I'm under severe restrictions in what I can say. Okay. For instance, we're just about to read it at the end here. He is not allowed to unravel the myth for us. Because, look at the very end of this section, that would be a matter beyond the scope and purpose of this narrative. Okay. We should recognize this, that this is part of his revelatory mandate. He couldn't even talk about it in any direct fashion. He just had to refer to the legend. That's all he could do. Okay.
Does it get straightened out in the next paper?
Yeah, it's in the Jesus papers. They totally unravel the whole myth. They give you every detail. You know, they even state right in there. And you know that legend about how they visited the newborn child in the manger? You know, that's how that myth, and here's how that myth got created. You know, they tell you that, they explain all that. They unravel that. Gavalia was not allowed, you know, and it may not be so much that it's verboten, because obviously the midwares did it. It's just like he says here, it's a matter beyond the scope and purpose of this narrative. They gave me a very definitive purpose and scope of this narrative, and that's outside of it. Okay, but I want to make sure you understand, I'm talking about the Magi, you know, that you know about, that you have a legend about.
Chris?
Yeah.
So you're saying, if I'm right, that the revelators are telling us that the Magi came weeks earlier when he was still a newborn.
No.
No?
No. They are not telling you that. He came when Jesus was almost 3 weeks old and he was not a newborn. See, a fact finder says what the revelators are telling me. No, the revelators are not telling you that. The revelators are not telling you that your legend is true. They're obviously not telling you. I mean, even we, before the fifth epical revelation, know that that legend is not factual. The Bible tells you that's just a legend. That's known. You know, the revelators are not going to tell you the sky is green.
What, Chris?
You know? So sky's blue.
So who are the wise men that visited the newborn child?
These guys here.
No. The wise men visited. But no wise men visited the newborn child in the manger. That's a legend. It didn't happen.
The writer of the book.
But Gavalia,
the revelator, put it in that way.
Gavalia had to say it that way. Okay? The important thing is to recognize what that he's functioning like he said he is. Notice how severe his restriction is. It's so severe, the only way he can refer to this is to refer to the legend. He can't refer to it factually. He's not allowed to. If you don't recognize that, you're totally misunderstanding what's going on in this section.
It's material mindedness.
You're thinking like the apostles always did with Jesus, and you go, Nathaniel, how long was it? Why must you insist upon looking at it with such simple-mindedness? Get a bigger sense of things in your head. You know? Don't be so simplistic in your thinking. Don't be so fact-finder. Okay? This is a great example. I mean, I would hope that someday some readers would get tired of the tedium of fact finders, rationalizers, and deconstructors. You know, it gets even worse. You know, You got people who want to use deconstruction to engage this revelation. It's like, well, you know, words can mean anything, you know, and I think that, no. The revelation has a definitive meaning. Seek it. It's not written by Bob, okay, who does it, who just uses words because they sound fun and, you know, and you can deconstruct his novel and go anywhere with it. Okay? This is a fifth epical revelation. And it requires you to have integrity. And this is the monument to this fact. The fact that this, that everyone has been completely stumbling over themselves with this one sentence. Like I said, it's the monument to this problem in the revelation. You know, and the reason I went through that, you know, a bit of the rationalization is just, you know, if you think that you can't rationalize it, find someone who's smarter and can rationalize it better, okay? You can rationalize anything. I mean, I was smart enough to derationalize the rationalization. Well, we could find someone smarter than me who could re-rationalize my derationalized rationalization. Okay, this is not going to get us anywhere. Okay, stop rationalizing. Stop. Step back and see it for what it is. It's another great example of, if you want to really appreciate the Jesus papers, you've got to know the Bible. You've got to know what we know about the Bible. If you're reading the Jesus papers and you think that in the Bible it says that the wise men visited the newborn child in the manger, or that, you know, then you haven't met the initial assumption that the revelators, that the midwayers had when they wrote that. The midwayers assume that you're up to speed. You know the Bible, you know the thinking about the Bible, because they're speaking to people there.
See, they couldn't have come out of Catholicism.
I mean, if you know, remember what it says in the beginning of the book. More or less distortion of meaning. It's your choice. If you haven't done the work in advance, it's going to be more given. You know, even if you've done a lot of work in advance, you're still going to be struggling with the less distortion of meaning. But try your best. Make it less and not more.
Is anything else missing from my book besides the manger?
No, that is the sentence.
That is the sentence.
I'm
really mad.
There's only one.
Like, who had the audacity to do it? Period.
Yeah. How do they explain putting it back?
Well, with a rationalization scheme, you know, like I said. I mean, but see, all of that is just completely irrelevant, you know?
Really?
It has nothing to do with the revelation. All that kind of, you know, ruminating thinking. You got to step back and see it in truth. You know?
Your argument even included a defense of the Contact Commission. I bet all of them knew the Bible just as well as Doc Sadler. And if Christie was even taking notes, I doubt she was taking notes at that point. Yeah. I think they were getting...
Remember, it's in the first printing. It's not in the second printing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. And
a lot of water is under the bridge between the first printing and the second printing. We all know about that.
If they knew the Bible, like you said, and they probably had a jump in their mind when they said they saw in the manger, they probably thought, why is that in?
Yeah, and seeing if they would just, I mean, go up and read Jesus' fifth year. You'll see a list in there. It defines newborn child, first 8 days, suckling child, yeah, et cetera, wean child. I mean, it's just right there. You know, he was not a newborn child. Yeah, so, see, this is a test. If you go, well, this, you know, this proves that this book is false, that whoever wrote this is clueless, because he was neither a newborn child or in the manger. Throw this thing away. We proved that it was written by Bob, and it's just a big ruse. No, what you've seen is a reflection in the mirror. Those thoughts are a reflection of you, not a reflection of the revelation. Challenge yourself to not be subject to that. You know that's not true. At least you should, if you're still reading this book. You know that's not true. Okay? So now challenge yourself to have a high enough perspective that you don't stumble over this. He had to say, I'm referring to those magi in your myth. He had to say that. Why did he have to say that? Why did he say anything at all? Like I said, if he hadn't said it, we'd be writing a whole big long story about these other guys that came besides the magi and blah, 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 blah. You know. Okay. He's got to nail it down, but he has these severe limitations. He's not allowed to go into the details of the bestowal. He can't unravel even that myth. But notice what he does. He pushes it to the limits. He can say one thing and he says it. The only supernatural event associated with the birth of Jesus was this announcement to Arnon and his associates. That is cool to know. All that, that myth that is now a legend about the Star of Bethlehem and all that rigmarole, magi and all that, with all of its magic thing, where they just happened to journey all the way from Ur and got there, the one night that Jesus is sleeping in the manger, because they were, moved there magically, that's why they constructed that myth. They wanted to, remember what they say, they were well-meaning zealots. Okay? Is it not ironic that the well-meaning zealots 2,000 years ago created that myth, and well-meaning zealots are still stumbling over that myth today?
Yeah, there's the poetry.
Yeah. That's
poetry. This could have been solved with two quotation marks.
Yeah, could have. But then it wouldn't have been a test. Yeah. It's just like, I've pointed this out many times. Jesus made sure that he didn't put quotes around the things he said like that. He wanted it as a test. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. He who does not have ears to hear, I'm going to make it so you're going to fall right flat on your face. I want to separate the wheat from the chaff. That's why I'm here. Choose this day. Are you wheat? Or are you chaff? And I'm the catalyst. I'm the sift, that separates the two. Okay? The revelation is the same way. Look at those who stumble over it and those who don't. And what do you see? Okay? He who has ears to hear, let him hear.
Revelators use words very specifically.
Mm-hmm.
And all of those things are consistent throughout the writing.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can look over here and you can look over here and you can point to these things and say, this is why I think as an intelligent reader of this book,
mm-hmm.
that these mean these things, and that's the meaning,
right,
that they're applying here.
Yeah.
So the deconstructor might say,
yeah,
Chris is parsing this thing,
right,
but he's insisting that this word means that.
And I can't change that impression.
Right.
Okay, that's how they see the world.
But that's why I'm saying that the first foundation is the intelligence, the perspective,
you gotta have,
and the truth.
Right. And, they are very precise. They didn't say suckling child. That's not the myth. The myth is newborn child in the manger. That is the myth. Okay? That's the legend.
And it forms some boundary layer for...
There are... this. Not to belabor this too much more, but there's other examples like this where you have a direct fact that if you engage it with a mere fact finder consciousness, you're going to have more distortion of meaning. You've got to see, the purpose is not to reveal facts. It's not that they're going to, corrupt facts, but there are limitations. They can't reveal The Hubble constant to 12 decimal places. That's a violation of the revelatory mandate. You know, if they're going to mention the Hubble constant, they have to mention the value that was back in the 20s. You know? So you're going, well, why even mention it? Well, you know that if there must be some great, you know, really significant reason to bring in a fact which is not precise or accurate. Okay? And so step back and figure out what that is. And if you can figure out why they would put that in there, you're going to get a better sense of what's going on. Okay? All right. Well, let's wrap her up.
Jesus' human parents were average people of their day and generation. And this incarnated Son of God was thus born of woman and was reared in the ordinary manner of the children of that race and age. The story of Michael's sojourn on Urantia, the narrative of the mortal bestowal of the Creator's Son on your world, is a matter beyond the scope and purpose of this narrative.
There it is.
Which also places this paper as with the other set.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can imagine that the midwayer is observing the restrictions that these revelators were under. That could have been part of their motivation for asking permission to lay out the full story. And then you go, well, why did they get permission if it wasn't given to others? Well, they are telling it firsthand.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
You know, they are allowed to tell it as they saw it. And you remember, the midwayers are very honest. Okay, we were watching this, but I'm afraid we're clueless as to what was really going on there, because all I can tell you is what we saw, and we know that there's many things that we can't see. And we, you know, and we always are very careful to tell you when our vision is limited, because, you know, we don't want you to think that we've got this all pinned down. You know, we could be wrong here. You know, but as far as we know, this is what happened, and this is why. You know? See, so you're going, well, geez, you know, I mean, why would God give me a revelation where I could trip over the ignorance of midwayers in it? This is an experiential domain. You have to choose to not be limited by the ignorance of others. That's a great truth to learn. If you can learn it from studying, you know, the fifth epical revelation, fantastic. But you can learn it without the fifth epical revelation. Don't limit yourself to the ignorance of others. You've been given everything you need to transcend the ignorance of others. Have you made use of that? You know, or are you a hopeless victim of antecedent causation? Bob says boo and you jump. You know, Bob says believe my ism and you go, okay. You know, are you sophistry proof? That's the kind of thing that's in play here.
I love the Bob.
It kind of shows to me how many who have very able minds don't have comparable spirit to see these things, and yet the twins, the Alpheus twins, had very simple minds, but they might have had huge spirits that,
yeah,
you know, or spirits that were able to engage, you know, enough with that mind.
They knew their limits. They knew,
yeah,
I'm not going to think about that because I'll be confused. I'll get it all confused. You know, they knew their limits. You know, they had magnificent humility. You know, we've talked about that a lot. It's those who have the bigger intellects that stumble.
Yeah, that's good.
Be fogged by much thinking. Yep.
If we take on this revelation, or even Jesus, we're sure to get into trouble. You know, it's not really a prevention of it's.
Yeah.
It's a promise to go there with us to the
end.
Yeah,
it's not just independent cosmic thinking.
Courageous.
Because you're going to experience, you know, as soon as you exert some effort, what's the first thing you experience? Struggle. Then what's next? Is it better? No. Conflict. Okay.
Confusion.
Okay. effort, struggle, conflict, faith. You know, the faith has, is faith desirable? Then, there has to be three words that come before faith in that sequence. Yeah. The more you make an effort to engage this, the first thing you're going to experience is struggle and conflict with your initial assumptions. You're going to find where your initial assumptions come up short. They're going to come in conflict with what's in front of you. Now, do you have the courage to let go of those false initial assumptions? All right, let's take a moment. Next time, we'll wrap this up with the the culminating section. Let's take a moment here.